ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Do you want to know who's really responsible for Donald Trump becoming president? It's Alan Funt. Yes. He's the man who invented reality TV, kind of by bugging people.
There was something kind of pervy and boundary crossing that isn't easy to sentimentalize.
I'm Mark Fennell, and that is just one exceptionally weird individual who changed the course of history, but trust me, there are more, and you'll hear about them. Just search for No One Saw It Coming on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor, and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. Who do you pay in cash? Your hairdresser? Your plumber? Paying in cash often means you pay a lower price, and who doesn't like saving money? But when the saving comes because that income isn't declared, it's got a name, the shadow economy. It's thriving and it's costing us $20 billion a year. Also ahead, you've realised you've got a problematic relationship with drinking, you've worked all year to untangle yourself from something you know isn't good for you, and then Christmas rolls around. What's it like navigating your first Christmas after getting off the booze? It's all coming up here on ABC Radio National. But first, we've all had a moment like this, at least I hope you have, because it's a wonderful feeling where you encounter a building or a space that just takes your breath away. Maybe it's a lofty vaulted ceiling or it's intricate detailing, but somehow a building can move you emotionally. And sure, a conversation about architecture and design maybe feels a little out of step right now. So many Australians can't find four walls to call home in the middle of a housing crisis, but that's exactly why talking about design, good design, matters. Because the spaces we move through in life shape how we feel and how we live and how we connect with each other. And that is something my guests today understand deeply. You will know Kevin MacLeod from the TV show Grand Designs, which follows people building and renovating some pretty spectacular homes, and Tim Ross, comedian, broadcaster, and self-described design nerd. They met years ago. They bonded over their shared love of design. And since then, they've gone on to host a podcast together. And they will be touring the country early next year to talk about design in some of pretty iconic locations around Australia. Kevin and Tim, thank you so much for joining me on Life Matters.
Absolute pleasure.
Huge pleasure. Thank you.
Great. Love to hear it. Kevin, I might start with you. We'll solve Australia's housing crisis in a tick. I want to start with this idea of a place that's inspired or moved you. What springs to mind?
Oh, loads. I mean, you know, and it's always hard to pick out a favourite because, you know, every week, I mean, Tim and I are in the same boat. You know, you visit something, you get excited about it, and it's like we're like puppy dogs. We just turn up and then the next house you see, and you think, oh, no, this is my favourite. This is my favourite house. And then the next one, oh, no, no, this is even better. And the joy about visiting a place that it has that energy, you know, and it can be, look, it can be a library, it can be a tax office sometimes, it can be a cathedral or a little church or a scout hut. Whatever it is, if there's an energy about it and a beauty and a happiness, then you want to sort of feed off it. And I make no apology for the fact that it is quite an addictive thing to do, and it does buoy Tim and me up. I mean, we both love actually sharing that experience and talking about it as we're going through it together.
Absolutely. Tim, what about yourself?
I like this idea that, you know, it's so true, Kev, that every new house is your favorite and you feel like you're cheating on lovers every time. But the ability for a building to move you, and if you allow a building to move you, I think it's really quite special, and they can be so varied. And I laugh. I was in the Botanic Gardens years ago with when my kids were little, and they're running around on the grass. And there's this wonderful 1970s toilet block, public toilet block, and I took a photo of it for my Instagram. My wife said, "Oh, that you're going to get thousands of likes for a public dunny," and she was right. But that's important. So those sort of public buildings, the small public buildings, and when we consider them and someone cares about them, and you might just be stopping in there to have a wee, but they do a great job, and whether it's a great house or a library or a university building or a cinema building, they all have their place, and they can all charm us in their own ways.
Why shouldn't we be able to wee in something beautiful?
Oh, we totally should. I mean, there's one in Brunswick Heads in northern New South Wales by Christina Valdez, who's a wonderful architect, and every time I go into it, it smells a bit, but that's what public toilets do. But I just love it. And I wish more people would see the beauty in those civic spaces.
Kevin, what is the difference between, I was going to say bog standard, I'm sticking with it, public toilet, and something beautiful enough that Tim Ross is taking a photo of it and chucking it on Instagram? What design characteristics are we talking here?
It's sometimes really hard to put your finger on it and to figure out what it is, but it's always an energy, and it's usually it's to do with the energy that went into making something that's beautifully made and done with passion and that has got lots of input and love and care in it, that it'll reverberate to those qualities of craftsmanship. It'll reverberate forever, and that's the magic thing. Is the energy that goes into a building and a space only needs to happen once, and then it sort of multiplies and reverberates and carries on echoing. It's great.
But is there not like ratios or rules or balance? Surely it can't just be like vibes.
Well, you know, there's this whole kind of argument about whether or not there are principles in design and whether or not there are kind of numerical kind of rational ideas behind it. But all I do know is that I'm constantly being wrong-footed by buildings that I didn't think I might like, or which don't conform to an agreed canon of what should be beautiful or whatever. You can get it in the smallest of spaces, as Tim pointed out, and you can get it in the largest. You can get it in the most ancient of public squares and the most minor inconsequential thing. You can get it from a really well-made teaspoon, frankly. It's the value of design.
Yeah, and what gets put into it, the love that gets into it. Like, you know, a curried egg sandwich that my mother used to make for me has the same materials in it than a curried egg sandwich that I can buy at the service station. You know, the same bread from the supermarket, everything. But why would mum's sandwich taste better? Because mum made that with love. And I'm nothing against the wonderful people who make sandwiches for the service station, but it is a different intent. And so, yeah, everyone starts with the same ingredients, but when we put together with care, things with care and thought, we do get a better result.
You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm speaking with Kevin McLeod from Grand Designs and Tim Ross, his partner in podcasting, because they are going to travel around the country early next year to talk about design in some iconic locations around Australia. But today they are talking to you and me about the buildings that move us and why. Jennifer, there's a building in Japan that inspired you. Tell me about it.
That's right. Thanks, Tegan, and huge fan of Grand Designs for many, many years. I live in a very bushfire-prone area up on the far north coast, and so we've built our house, you know, out of locally milled timber, but have felt that it's just not viable with the increasing risk of bushfires. And I was lucky enough to go to Naoshima Island in Japan and see incredible brutalist cement museums designed by Tadao Ando, and realised that actually something that was fireproof can also be beautiful, and with really clever, simple design, allow things like natural light in. And so we're rebuilding our house out of cement, which feels kind of in some ways, you know, a challenge to the beautiful ancient Widjibal Wobble land that we're on, but also understanding that it's, you know, it's a changing world, but being really inspired about what's possible with a material that we wouldn't have thought of.
That's beautiful, Jennifer. Thank you so much for the call. I love this idea of being inspired, not just emotionally, but really practically on what you can do in your own space. Fiona, you've called in. Prague left an impression on you. Tell me about it.
Yes, my partner and I were lucky enough to be travelling for some time, and we'd been to a number of countries, thought we'd seen a lot. Arrived in the late afternoon in Prague, was staying in a what used to be a nunnery. So we had a huge high-ceilinged room. So that was a sort of introduction to sort of feeling that there, this was something special. Walked a couple of hundred yards to the river. And by that time, the sun had gone down and the lights had come up. And I thought I was in fairyland. And it wasn't any particular building. I could not pick a building out of Prague that I'd say was better than the others. Everything, like the mishmash of all the Renaissance, Baroque, everything that had gone through those the centuries of building that city, sort of all mashed together to make turn into something really sensational. And we both were just stunned when we got to the river, looking at the buildings and how they were set against it. Even the trees were surrounded by these enormous ornate wrought iron protection zones, and it was the detail. Everything where you looked, they had sort of, it seemed to have been built layer by layer over centuries with sort of incredible care and finesse, and yeah, it was an extraordinary feeling.
Fiona, that's such a beautiful point, that idea of the thought that goes into design, but also the way the elements of a city interact with each other and the natural environment. Kevin, we focus so much on like my house, your house, the house that you're building on Grand Designs, but talk to me about what makes a city work harmoniously together.
Oh, that's a good one.
Putting you casually on the spot there.
Yeah, no, I think it's a really, really interesting thing, because I was in Germany recently, and in Germany there's a thing called Kehrwoche, which happens every month. And when you buy a house or you rent a place, you sign up to volunteer and give a day, a month of your time to sweep the streets and look after the bit of public realm that's outside your building. And it's why German villages and towns are so extraordinarily beautifully kept. And I think it does come down to people. It doesn't matter how beautiful the setting, doesn't matter how, you know, intensely magical the architecture is. Frankly, if people aren't happy in a place, and if the place doesn't make them happy, and if they don't connect to it, I think that's sort of fundamental. I went to Christchurch, you know, shortly after the earthquake, and then to the rebuilt, you know, the Carbo Cathedral, and that was one of the first buildings to go up, and I just think that it is, sometimes it takes crisis and it takes, you know, a realization and a desire from people to kind of take control of their public realm and take control of their spaces and to want to take, you know, to sort of properly do democracy in action for places to spring alive. But it has to be, doesn't it? I think it has to be people in the end, because in the end you think, it's all very well having the most, you know, beautiful little, you know, bit of public realm, some trees in the square. But frankly, I think people in any place want to feel that it's theirs and that there should be no boundaries between the private and the public almost.
Tim, you grew up in Melbourne. Do you feel like you got that feeling there, or is this something that's special that only happens overseas?
Oh, no. I mean, I love every city in this country for different reasons. And, you know, I always think about, the city of Melbourne. And on a personal, every time I walk through the streets of the city, they're full of the stories of my father. Because when I was a kid, we'd go up to see my uncle, who was the dentist, and, you know, I'd get my teeth filled. And then, but on the way, we'd have, you know, we'd walk up to the building, and Dad would tell me about when he was a kid, he'd go to this place and what that building was. And so they're so, the memories that are so embedded in those buildings. And of course, when we removed them, they're not just the buildings, they're the stories that go with them. So, yeah, I think every city has its magic, and we also like the hot mess of cities, I think. I think, you know, they have to be a bit rough around the edges. You know, I live in quite a nice suburb, but we've got a cafe where all these people who've got very, very nice houses sit on milk crates because they want to feel all urban. But similarly, you know, those small things, like I love that idea. I wish we could be a little bit like the Germans, like that. But we sort of do that without, we'll happily do that, but I don't think Australians would want to be tied into doing it once a month. I think we'd just rather help out when the time's right. But, you know, I was thinking about those little community, you know, libraries where people put a little box out the front of their house, and you can see how terribly or so well people read in your neighbourhood. But you think about, if you could walk down a street and you see one of those and it says, well, what's this street in this community saying to us? And what it's saying is that we're prepared to share and that we care and we also value reading and we value the idea of a small indication that there is a community that's vibrant here. And so the smallest little things can make our cities and suburbs work in wonderful ways.
Well, speaking of Melbourne, Cynthia's called in on 1300 225 576. Cynthia, you were moved by a museum in the Yarra Valley.
Oh, absolutely. Well, first of all, when you approach, it's a beautiful landscape and the building is most interesting. But once inside, I was instantly, physically overcome by the perfection of the space, the proportion, the simplicity. I just was transfixed. I just stood at the beginning and looked right through the spaces to the landscape beyond. And look, I've never had that experience from architecture before, so I had to share it.
This is the Tarawarra Museum of Art?
Yes, and Alan Powell was the architect. And that was 20 years ago. About 10 years ago, we decided to demolish and rebuild. And there was only one person that I could think of I wanted to design where I was going to live. And that's exactly what happened. And I don't live in a grand space like that. But I live in, how he designs. I just love it.
Thank you so much for the call. Tim, have you been to that museum before? What do you think about it?
I love this idea of liking Alan Powell's work and then giving him a call. But I mean, he was responsible for some great Melbourne buildings. And we all have that interaction. I had a similar thing. The Prince Hotel in St Kilda, he did the original alterations to that. And in my late 20s, I just loved hanging out in that place and have loved his work ever since. So it's a really delightful story, isn't it? That, yeah, like the architect who did the gallery, get him to do my house. How fabulous.
If you can afford it, that sounds amazing. This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm with Kevin McLeod and Tim Ross, hosts of Big Design Adventure, the podcast, and talking about design that moved you. And I do want to talk about the idea of being able to afford it, of being able to afford to live in a house at all. Kevin, there's a housing crisis across many parts of the world. We're feeling it really keenly here in Australia at the moment. Just to put you right on the spot, if you were in charge, how would you fix Australia's housing crisis?
Well, I'm not Australian, so I don't want to presume to kind of tell anybody what to do.
I'm anointing you right now here on the radio.
Yeah, you're making me world king.
Yes.
Yeah, I know.
Go on.
My answer would be very simply, okay, so this is what I'm trying to do in the UK because we've got a really, really similar problem, is I'm trying to get politicians to stop focusing on numbers because numbers are targets that sound great, but which no housing or supply chain industry really has any interest in delivering. If all we did was devote all our energies to delivering really cheap, affordable housing, then what would happen is we get an overflow of supply in the market, the price would crash, and all those businesses would go under. So no developers interested in doing that. What I think we need to focus on is quality. And we've forgotten this. We've forgotten about how it's possible to build really decent, beautiful homes for people and to give them a quality of life. There was something that happened in my country in the 1950s. It was a tiny thing. When local authorities, councils, built social housing for people in rural communities, villages and small towns, they always put the social housing just on the edge of the village. It was walkable, but with the very best view. Mm-hmm. They got the land that had the very best view because the people they were housing deserved it. And we've politically moved to a position where we think that social housing ought to be good enough. And it's a horrible phrase. We should really be devoting the best minds in the business of building and of designing to producing the very best quality of public realm buildings and empowering people and empowering communities. So for me, it's flipping it on its head, really. You know, I think we just have to get rid of probably 30 to 40 years of really poor and quite corrosive thinking.
Tim, do you think that has ever been the case in Australia?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you look at the first social housing that's still in operation here in this country from 100 years ago, absolutely beautiful, and did exactly that because it was the same as all housing that was going up. And when they were, say, in the 1950s and 60s, and they moved some of the people out of the suburbs, in the inner suburbs, say in Sydney, where they thought they were slums, moved people to the suburbs and built really great, super well-designed brick homes for people. And there was no stigma about social housing. It was for everyone, and we've painted ourselves into this terrible corner where we misunderstand who needs it. And so in every capital city in this country, we need social housing or affordable housing for our key workers, for our school teachers, our firemen and women, childcare workers, everyone. Mm. So they're not stuck on public transport or in the car for 3 hours a day. I mean, we actually, weirdly enough, cared more about people 40, 50 years ago than we do today. And this says a lot about where we've come.
I'm really enjoying reading your text on the text line 0418 226 576, with some really practical elements of design that moves you. Barbara says, more environmentally responsible, modest size architect homes, please. Not grandiose overbuilt structures which please the ego of the owner. A home which encourages interaction, not separation. And room for large shade-giving trees. Those are the places I love on Grand Designs. And another says, I'm moved by any building which responds to the environment crisis with low impact materials and low energy, as well as recycling waste and growing food if possible. Kevin, how do you see this done really well in some of the places you visited?
A lot of it's not rocket science. It's just about, it's almost through the way you design. If you start from the outside and work in, rather than thinking about, you know, the internally kind of hermetically sealed home. If you think about community and what you can put into a housing scheme that's shared, then you start in the right place. And I've had some kind of involvement, I mean, on and off with social housing for the past 20 years. And every scheme I've been involved with, the first question everybody was asked was, what can we get people to share? Is it is it parking? Is it a bike club? Is it a car club? Is it a kid's playground? Is it an allotment? Is it an orchard? Is it the fruit on the hedges that's in the public realm? Can they all own that? You know, and these are, it's kind of how we used to build out in the 16th, 19th, 5th, whenever it was, 20th century too. This idea that we can share our resources and consequently tread much more lightly on the planet. And I don't know why we think that somehow creating an independence in our world from other human beings, it makes us more resilient. It actually makes society weaker and less interactive and less enjoyable. And I think there was a great quote that somebody said to me from a charity called Bioregional, and who wrote the One Planet Living Guide. And they asked me once, how long do you think the average power tool gets used for in its entire life? And the answer to that, if you take that every single power tool you could imagine, right, the answer is 4 minutes. Because some of them never get out of the packaging, okay?
You're talking about my hedge trimmer, Kevin.
Mate, that's what you started using it on your beard, so that's okay. the point is, I've lost my thread now.
We could
share a load more stuff and we wouldn't notice, and life would become a lot easier and cheaper and better. Yeah.
I mean, I think it's really important to think that there's a lot of talk about multi-generational homes, and there'd be so many people listening now who have got children in their 20s who are still living at home and they're happy to have them at home. That was what we've always done. And this experiment in isolation is a post-1948 sort of phenomenon where we moved everyone out to the suburbs and away from our family units. And we've been missing it ever since. One of the things that actually keeps us close to our community and our family is multi-generational housing. But some of our sort of regulations hasn't caught up to that. And there's this great movement happening out of Adelaide where they're saying, well, why can't let's make it easier to turn existing homes on big blocks into not just two-bedroom homes or two household homes in terms of having the old-fashioned granny flat. But so why can't you have three separate homes there? Like, why can't we turn a garage into a one-bedroom unit that can be used for one of the kids, and you move through the house as time goes on? Because we all, I think, want to be much closer to our families than we certainly did when I was a kid.
You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm with Kevin McLeod and Tim Ross, and we're talking about good design. It can be socially responsible. It can be environmentally responsible. It doesn't have to be expensive. It just requires a bit of a change in our perspectives. One says, my house moves me. It's an ordinary cottage with a nondescript garden, but it serves me well. And when I arrive and open the door, I breathe out and relax. Another says, I nearly cried when I visited Foliota, designed by Walter Burley Griffin and Marion Marnie. It's an extraordinary house. Another says the Alhambra, hands down. That room with the ceiling of stars brought me to tears. Still does as I think of it. And another question for you, Kevin, from someone on the text line. Bron says, are we really designing homes for the next 30, 50, whatever years of extreme weather events that are being forecast? What are you seeing as you're looking into the future?
I think depending on the climate and where it's going in particular regions, obviously that's going to determine hugely how we build. In my country here, there's a great move towards building more in timber, partly because it's super sustainable, locks away carbon, and it also, if it's used correctly with technologies like cross-laminated lumber, you can make structures which are really fire resistant. In fact, there is a brand new fire station in Queensland, which has just been built out of timber, which I know sounds very counterintuitive, really, doesn't it? But actually, when you think about it, really, if timber building were to catch fire, the one building you'd really hope it was the fire station, because they could put it out. You know, they're there, right? Right. So I think but it's a lovely thing to have. And I think that I think the future in terms of trying to build, we've got to wean ourselves, much as the stories about concrete buildings are beautiful and it is a fabulous tactile material, we have to wean ourselves off the really carbon intensive materials like steel and concrete and much more towards buildings which can lock away carbon in all kinds of ways, whether it's hempcrete or using earth, clay or timber. Then I think that's probably where I think we're heading, and I think towards a much more passively really well insulated, well performing fabric in our buildings that doesn't require a huge amount of plastics as current building regs require, doesn't require lots of complicated layers, doesn't require high carbon materials. Yeah.
Tim, what do you see in Australia?
I think that the cross-laminated timber is really interesting because, you know, it can often slot together like a Meccano set, so it goes up quite quickly, and you know, it's cut to size, and there's great opportunities for that, and it's super sustainable in that way, and it will become cheaper, and that's what drives everything. You know, one of the biggest concerns, obviously, is the cost of building, but for every one of those things that happens, there's always, you know, houses going up all the time in this country that, outside of doing what they need to do within the regulations, aren't really truly responding to the place where we live, which is the most important thing in terms of landscape and not just sustainability, but our homes need to tell a story about who we are and where we live and how we want to live and represent the colours of this wonderful nation and the colours and of the bush, I think is really important.
Well, one of the reasons we're chatting today is because you two are planning a tour of Australia early next year. Tim, what are you looking forward to showing off to Kevin when he comes here?
Well, for the podcast and over the last 2 years of recording it, you know, Kevin's been most of the time been the host. So it's really about coming to all the cities and then finding some stories, and we'll do a lot of recording amongst the shows, but sort of in an old-fashioned way, being a tour guide and mm-hmm. introducing him to how, you know, the people of Brisbane and the architecture that I've fallen in love with in Brisbane. And I'm quite excited about that, to be a tour guide and do the reverse, because when we've been in the UK, I've sort of said, oh, I'm really interested in going to see that building, and Kevin's made it happen, which has been joyful. But also he's surprised me with all sorts of experiences that just completely moved me, and conversations that I'll remember forever, which I think is a total joy as well.
Yeah, so when it comes to Australian architecture, Kevin, you haven't had the Tim Ross tour yet, so maybe this is jumping the gun a bit, but do you have a favourite Australian style of architecture, and why is it the Queenslander?
Why is it the Queenslander? I mean, I do like a shack, and I do like buildings which are light and small and modest and which are not overblown. But of course, the point about Australia is that if you're trying to find countries in the world which speak of the 20th century loudly and clearly, Australia is one of the few that really shouts. And my country is full of rickety old buildings stuck together with dog lick and leaves and bits of tree, and it's all got it, everything's drafty and cold and windy and miserable half the year, and because we cling on to our history. And the glorious thing about Australia is visiting a city, any city, I mean, and Tim and I have already visited quite a few and together, and the there's an energy in the 20th century. I grew up with family in Australia sending us letters and pictures and photos, you know, and we were watching Australian television series on the telly growing up, and it was like looking into the future. So you know, whether it's Griffin or Robin Boyd or any of the greats, it's a precious place. And I think what's interesting about that is I'm not quite sure that Australians quite understand the what they have. There's a kind of fantastic 20th century catalogue of architecture in Australia, which is so rare internationally, and I think I'm looking forward to just Tim showing me, yeah, the best bits and his favourite bits as well. Yeah.
I mean, I remember you a decade ago saying to me that, you know, it's like the rest of the world is looking towards our domestic and residential architecture, and it's always stuck with me. And this year I've been doing a live show, and I've been showing this photo of this house in Victoria by Bright Architects, Studio Bright, and in it, I talk about how in some ways we're better at residential architecture than we are at sport on the world stage, and everyone sort of, you know, laughs and goes, I think it's true. And that particular house was just awarded, you know, the Design House of the Year out of every house that was built last year and designed last year all over the world for that reason, because it's a great designed house that blends with our landscape. And I think the world, particularly since the advent of Instagram, has been looking increasingly towards what we do.
I'm really interested to pick up on that idea of the really visual, the Instagram side of things. Like, it's great to be showcasing Australian design overseas, love it, celebrate it. But also with a TV show like Grand Designs and with Insta and other social media sites, it's a very visual medium, and design is visual, but it's not only visual. Kevin, do you think that the very visual nature of those media warps our idea of what a good home should feel like?
Yeah. I mean, with Grand Designs, we spend a lot of time trying to figure out how we can convey the experiences of a building rather than just what it looks like. But inevitably, it's telly, it's moving pictures, so people, of course, make their judgments. And people make judgments about buildings from photographs on the internet, on, you know, online platforms and in magazines, and without ever visiting a place, which is hilarious. So Tim and I spend a lot of time talking about this, and we have a phrase which we don't use ever, which we don't like, which is three words, which is get the look. when we started talking about the podcast, because it's just us two, right? We produce it. We just wanted to do it for fun, just for us. That's why we did it. And there was this big question, like, do we take photographs of the building? Do we show any footage? Do we film them? And when we go to places, I mean, we went to Denmark last year. Went to a couple of amazing places there. And of course, you know, the phone comes out and you're capturing anything, you're snapping like crazy and taking all the videos and photographs you can get to sort of somehow remind you of the experience of being there. But you've also got to stand still and listen to the acoustic of a building. You've got to kind of walk through it. You've got to experience it. Talk to the people that are there. We turned up at a church designed by Jørn Utzon, you know, the Danish architect who did the Sydney Opera House. We turned up at this church at Bagsværd, and it wasn't open because I'd screwed up because I thought it was open. And but that was okay because there was a lady who let us in, and there was a child. It was a baby yoga class going on just next to the altar. In this amazing space. And we just, it was just a magical thing. We didn't need to talk to the babies or the children, but clearly they were rolling around loving being in this building and experiencing something quite precious. And to just sit there and just see them, and then when they'd left, just to experience the building empty was just magical. So we put very little visual material up, and we do a lot with sound, because I think we've all become slaves to pictures.
I think it's worth saying also at that particular place, there was a couple from Adelaide who were riding their bikes around Europe, who happened to stop at the church as well. And they getting off their bike and they're having a sandwich or something, and they go, "Oh my God, hello Rosso, how are you?" We started having a chat. And then Kevin walked around the corner. Oh my God. Did they get excited?
That sounds amazing.
Oh my God, bubble. Kevin's here too.
Oh, Kevin's here too. We love it.
What a coincidence.
So, final thoughts. Tim, if you're not getting the look, what are you getting?
Oh, in terms of
If this sort of sense of like, get the look, like if you love what you're seeing here or what you're hearing about or experiencing, what do you hope people are trying to emulate, if not just sort of what throw rug to buy?
I mean, I'm not in the business of telling people how to live, and there is always joy to be had in finding something new and exciting that makes you feel that you're part of something or that you're at the front of something. Or I think homes are about people, and houses that I like are the ones that I always feel like there's a life well lived in them. And so that's a collection of things that mean something to them. So rather than going out and buying prints or something, or rather to fill their house with things that they feel that they need to, I would rather see things that are tell a story of their family. And they say, well, you know what, I'm going to hold on to this chair that was my grandmother's because that tells the story of my family, and there's memories embedded in that. That's my personal taste, but I've been to plenty of places where none of that happens that I enjoy as well. It's horses for courses and stuff, but I just love homes that just feel like life is magical and chaotic and gorgeous, and kids have been there and moved and come back, and I think Kev, what did you say? Like the kitchens are always great when there's something on the pot. You know, that's
something like that. It's true, isn't it?
But
you've just hit you just hit the nail on the head there, Tim, because it's the difference between looking at, you know, getting the look and looking at a room and saying, "I want that." That's completely alien to what we do. For in our podcast, we tell stories, and the only way we make sense of the world is by telling stories. And the most interesting places have the most fabulous stories, and sometimes they're funny and sometimes they're sad. But it's the stories that spring places alive. It's the story that springs the teaspoon alive, mm-hmm. if it's been made by, you know, somebody who cares about what they're doing for a living. And I always think if you know, you can buy something, or you can spend the same amount of money, and you can, or near enough, and you can have it made by somebody down the road. And all of a sudden, as an object, it becomes a vessel. It doesn't. It's not just the object. It's all the human emotion bound up, and all the energy bound up in the thing that actually is communicated from people to people. And the stories resonate on down, and amazingly, over time, they get better. Mm. So I think that's what we're in the business of doing. Tim and I are both storytellers, really. We're both broadcasters. We're both people who've done shows, and Tim does stand up too. And I have to say, the one thing I'm really looking forward to about our tour in February is the fact that pretty well everybody who's coming to see us is already a fan of the podcast. And that means they've heard some of the stories and they're going to bring their own. And it's sort of, we're all in the same club. Do you know what I mean? And if, look, we didn't know if it was going to work. We didn't know if the podcast was going to get any listeners. And it's taken off. It's been wonderful. And so we kind of feel like we did the right thing. We made the right move, you know, not putting loads of pictures up saying, give us a thumbs up or a thumbs down for this picture of a house that could be anywhere on the planet.
Absolutely. Well, Kevin, Tim, thank you both so much for joining me today. It has been such a delight talking human-centered design with both of you. Kevin McLeod is, of course, the host of the TV show Grand Designs. Tim Ross is a comedian, broadcaster, and self-described design nerd. Their show is called Big Design Adventure. They're going to be here in February next year. And thank you for telling me about the buildings that move you. One says, the Comprehensive Cancer Centre in Melbourne took my breath away. The why? Its purpose. Because it's been designed to lift the spirits of people and families facing challenging life circumstances. And the other one says, the Vallejo Ganta Hut in the Victorian High Country. An A-frame that sits perfectly in the landscape. Glass front mezzanine, beautifully aged timber, and a central stone fireplace. The hut provides shelter from the elements for countless hikers and skiers. If I ever get a chance to build a house, it will be inspired by this. Well, stick with me here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Up next, when you get a discount for paying in cash, how hard do you think about why the price is cheaper?
It is a truth universally acknowledged that on one's 250th birthday, there should be a celebration. I'm Claire Nichols, and on The Book Show, we're raising our teacups to Jane Austen.
Why Austen? What is it about her?
Authors Colm Tobin, Karen Joy Fowler, and more will explore why, in 2025, the Austen effect is bigger than ever.
That's quite incredible.
Dear Jane, on The Book Show Mondays at 10 on ABC Radio National or anytime on the ABC Listen app.
Have you ever asked a hairdresser or a tradie if they can do a better price for cash? Or maybe you've done work for someone and got paid cash in hand, or a friend has a small business with a percentage of income generated under the table. Australia's shadow economy is thriving. Industries as varied as building and beauty among those operating outside the tax system. With me is Tony Godding, Assistant Commissioner and Chair of the ATO's Shadow Economy Task Force. Tony, welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you for having me on today, Tegan.
What do we mean by shadow economy?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's certainly not something that most people would be across in their day-to-day life. And when we try and explain it, effectively, you've hit the nail on the head. It really involves economic activities that are deliberately hidden from authorities to avoid tax or regulation. And when we sort of break that down a little bit for where tax has got an interest, it's around, you know, people are not declaring their income, they're demanding or being paid for working cash. You know, they're failing to report all their sales, or, you know, their lifestyles certainly don't match their known income. They're the most common sort of things that we see from a tax perspective. Although I would note, shadow economy is not just about tax. It's about the entire regulatory system as well.
What do you mean by that?
So when we have a look at it from the Shadow Economy Task Force perspective, we quite often get tip-offs from the community around a number of different things that they're seeing across the community, and that could be quite varied. For example, we get close to 1,000 tip-offs a week from the community who see things that they don't think's quite a fair go, and that can include people that perhaps are accessing welfare benefits who should be, or are not doing the right thing by the NDIA, et cetera. So it's not just purely tax. It's those other elements that hang off the regulatory system that all come together for, you know, basically people not doing the right thing. And as you know, most Aussies are pretty, you know, pretty across everyone gets a fair go. And when they see someone, you know, taking advantage of the system, increasingly they're letting us know.
This is the part that I wanted to kind of get to. In a one sense, is there a bit of a, like, don't ask, don't tell. Like, I'm doing the right thing over here. You want me to pay you in cash? Sure. Like, why do I care? What's the bigger footprint of this shadow economy?
Yeah, it's a really good point. And I think it's quite easy often for us, for all as individuals, to go, okay, well, that's not my problem. I've done the right thing, or I feel like I've done the right thing. And you know, if that person doesn't do it, that's on them. But the trouble is with the shadow economy is it's not just having a go at the tax office, and you know, that used to be Australian sport a couple of years ago, to be honest. The money that's not going into the tax system is effectively money that's not going to the community. So you're not having a go at the tax office, you're basically ripping off the community. And when that adds up, it's now in excess of $20 billion, which isn't going into the things that, you know, we all need and enjoy in our lives, like roads, doctors, hospitals. So it's not, I think the really interesting point here is while we can take that position as an individual, as a community, we're missing out.
What kinds of industries are we seeing this more? Like, it's easier in some industries than others to operate with cash. Where are you seeing most of this?
Yeah, 100%. And where we do see that, certainly, we do have high-risk industries. And when we have a look at our top three, whether they be in the country, in the city, no matter what state and territory we look at, there's three main ones that consistently come through for us. So building and construction, cafes and restaurants, and hairdressing and beauty services are generally our top three. And as you noted in your intro, it is easier in those industries to operate in cash. And let me be quite clear about cash. Cash is still certainly legal tender. It's something I get asked a lot. Is this a crackdown on cash? No, it's not. It's unfortunately for some people, cash is just too much of a temptation, perhaps not to do the right thing. So it's certainly legal. You can pay your workers in cash. You can certainly pay for services in cash. But unfortunately, when someone tends to offer you a discount for that, they're not only undermining the honest business down the road, it's not, but what other corners might they be cutting when they're doing that? I mean, we hear it all the time. I'm up here on the Sunshine Coast. We've got a problem at the moment with dodgy roof restoration. Now, I'm sure they're all being paid in cash. And what happens then when you try and get recourse on that if something goes wrong? Well, too often than not, we all know the outcome of that. They disappear and you're left with a dodgy roof.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to Tony Godding, who's the Assistant Commissioner and Chair of the Shadow Economy Task Force with the Australian Taxation Office, talking about paying in cash, the fact that cash-only economy on which no tax is paid is costing us as taxpayers $20 billion a year. And so it's something that they're cracking down on at the moment. Alex says most small shops are now encouraging cash by charging fees for using a card, often at a much higher rate than the transaction cost. It clearly would be more expensive to handle cash if they weren't dodging tax. The sooner the card surcharges are made illegal, the better. Well, Tony, there has been a really sharp move away from cash in lots of industries, including hospitality. Like, the coffee shop downstairs from here won't accept cash at all. Has that made tracking this easier?
Look, to a degree it has, although it's quite interesting when you have a look at, as an economy, how we've bounced out of the pandemic. The RBA still estimates there's over 2 billion notes in circulation. So I think whilst we've seen a reduction of cash, it's certainly still out there. And the point your text line person made about the fees is an interesting one. There's certainly, if you have a look at the work that's been done through ASBEFIO, so the Australian Small Business and Family Ombudsman's area, they're very, I guess, on the front foot about things called low-cost routing. So if you are in a business listening today and you are getting paid too many fees on your electronic transactions, we encourage you to actually have a look at what you can get, because low-cost routing is actually now something that banks are supposed to offer to reduce that cost. But I totally take your point, Tegan. There are many places now that don't. And in fact, where we see that, you're quite correct, it then starts to show where we do have some of those issues with cash. Because like most industries that are out there, the Australian Tax Office, of course, has a wide range of data and intelligence on them. And we have things called industry benchmarks. And what they mean is when we have a look at, say, a cafe, we've got a fair idea of what their turnover versus their expenses should be. So when we start to see gaps in that, that's often a tell for us that there could be a problem.
Another text here says high cash businesses also have a high risk of worker exploitation, including modern slavery. Tony, is that true?
Unfortunately, it is, Tegan. Recently, we've just concluded an operation in Gatton in Queensland called Operation Topaz, where we were having a look at labour hire operators, quite dodgy ones, unfortunately, in the agricultural industry. And of the 7 locations we visited, we've unfortunately had to undertake audits on over 50 taxpayers, which has resulted in recovering around $25 million worth of stolen worker entitlements. So you're quite correct. They were cash businesses where workers effectively were being ripped off. They weren't getting the right rate of pay. They certainly weren't getting things like sick leave or annual leave. And as far as superannuation, that just wasn't occurring. So we do see that correlation. And in fact, a couple of, or certainly one of those labour hire operators who's no longer in business, I might add, as a result of our operations, was also in the business of taking people's passports off them when they went into the field, which is just a deplorable behaviour in this country.
So, Tony, you're the chair of the Shadow Economy Task Force at the ATO. But is it realistic to think you're going to be able to eradicate this entirely? I mean, Godspeed and all the best, but like, you know.
No, you're quite correct. This is a community issue, and that's probably the key point I'd like to get across to everyone listening today. We certainly can't audit our way out of this. This isn't about, you know, giving more people sledgehammers and telling them to squash ants. That'll never achieve the outcome we want. What we're really asking the community to do is just consider some of those transactions that you get into. And where you do see some of those behaviours that perhaps don't seem right, to let us know about it. Making a tip off to the ATO is really easy. You can give us a call on 1-800-060-062. It's completely anonymous. Or, of course, you can do the same through our website. Just look for tip off on the ato.gov site and let us know about it. But effectively, if we don't change community attitudes towards participation in this, it's only going to get worse.
Very briefly, there are quite a few people on the text line, Tony, saying that ATO should be targeting big corporations for their tax contributions rather than individuals and small businesses. What do you reckon?
It's certainly a question I get asked all the time. And when I have a look at the shadow economy gap, which is my area of focus, in the main, it is being driven by small business, not large business at all. So large business don't actually feature in that $20 billion plus figure. That's not something we look at. Unfortunately, it is being driven by small businesses.
Well, Tony, thank you so much for joining me today. Tony Godding is the Assistant Commissioner and Chair of the ATO's Shadow Economy Task Force. On the text line, one person says, paid $400 cash for an electrician to fix a shorted power circuit in the house. It shorted again after he left, wasted money. He stiffed me as well as his obligations to the ATO. But that is almost it for Life Matters, coming to you today from Jagera and Turrbal Land. Earlier in the show, I had the absolute delight and pleasure to talk to Tim Ross and Kevin McLeod about good design. And I was asking you about the building that moved you, and I have been moved by your beautiful texts about these spaces that you love. One says, the building that moves me is my 1930s weatherboard two-bedroom house that I bought in Queanbeyan, New South Wales in 1994. But my migrant Italian mother thought it should be condemned because it wasn't brick and didn't have a lot of concrete painted green. Another text says, the Alastair Knox iconic mud brick Eltham Library embodies warmth, connection and the stories of the area so well. It's magical to watch my 7-year-old wander the Warren-like insides like I and a generation before me did. Leela says, houses are homes. It's a place which moves our spirits, not just places to sleep and be safe in, so much more. The place we can play a board game, sit on the veranda with a neighbour, bake a cake for a friend, grow a plant, do a craft, have a bookcase with favourite poems. Ben Dyer says, the building that moved me is the second hut on the Overland Track in Tasmania, built on the edge of a natural grass area. big north-facing windows with an amazing view across the grassland to eucalypts and a huge rock face in the distance. Most amazingly, this was built in a very small footprint, so while it was brand new when we arrived, there was no mess or mud, a real quality piece of architecture that is in tune with the landscape and is exceptional for the hikers who use it. Well, that is almost it for Life Matters, coming to you today from Jagera and Turrbal Land. Tomorrow on the show, I will be back with you again, talking about housing again, talking about empty houses around Australia and how they maybe could be part of our solution to the housing crisis, plus our healthy food system, some new ideas on how we can get to a healthier way of making eating healthy the path of least resistance for Australians. That's tomorrow on Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'll catch you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.